So now we're starting to get into the nitty-gritty here. How do you actually stage a major event? We've got a room full of people, experts involved in organising major events, and we've got a panel of five brilliant experts on this very theme here, and organisers and suppliers side by side. So very much looking forward to hearing what they've got to say. I'll pass you over to Robert and Dat now to introduce the panel. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ben. Welcome to this panel, which is entitled, as you can see, Reimagining Major Event Delivery. And we've been asked to focus on looking at the future, but I suppose building on lessons from the past, looking at why some event hosts deliver better events than others, and we may need to define what better means, and how the sharing of knowledge is passed between future, past and future hosts, and how maybe some of that can be increased. We're also going to look at outsourcing. We've got, we'll introduce the panel in a second, experts in providing outsourced solutions. But, you know, is there a turnkey solution? And are there models that have worked? And some have worked well, some have worked less well in terms of outsourcing. And does it work for mega events as well as for single sports events? And then finally, we'll also be looking at functional areas that require the most expertise from international experts and what 2022 and beyond might look like. And to answer those questions, we have a very esteemed panel. On my right, Neil Carney, who, amongst many other things, project director currently for the 2022 Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. Next to Neil is Nadia Burkhart, the event supervisor for the Eurovision Song Contest within the EBU. Next to Nadia is David De Beer, head of sales and major events at Aggreko Event Services. Another David Tunnicliffe, commercial director at GL Events. And finally, at the end of the row, Kevin Menk, head of sales for sports events at Ruhrda. What I'm going to do is just make a quick reminder. I think Ben mentioned it, which is, I think now this portal is open, this internet portal, pigeonhole.at. And the password is HC in uppercase 2018. And you're very welcome. And I think your questions will appear on my phone, hopefully by magic. And of course, we'll take other questions in the normal way. But if you'd like to ask a question that way, I'll try and pick it up. I was going to do what Paul Bush did, really, and go along the row and ask each of our panelists in turn to reflect on the topic, to reimagine what major event delivery looks like in the future, and perhaps in 2022, in your case, Neil, and maybe beyond.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for having me here. You use the word esteemed. I kind of look around me and say, well, it's not me. But thank you for having me nonetheless. I think it's a really interesting topic, and I think what we heard this morning, I would expect some of what we'll end up discussing probably be along a similar theme. Anorak Pease here, historian at heart, historian by qualification, and I think using the word reimagining itself is a little bit profound there. So the topic could have been titled Imagining What It Looks Like in the Future. Let's forget everything we've done because apparently it was bad and think of the future. But it really is just taking that moment to reflect, learn from the past, because lots of really good things work. But I think it's when we look to the future, it's what's that sense of partnership, what's that collaboration between organising committees, between host cities, between suppliers. And there will be natural tensions in that space. Are cities competing with each other to host events? They are. Are suppliers competing with each other to win contracts? Yes, they are. Are rights holders competing with each other? Yes, they are, because they want to get the best place for their event. So I think, but it's how do we create a safe space for some of those natural tensions? And even events like this really do help with that. We can have some of those corridor conversations that probably are not necessarily something where there's an existing other forums where we could have it. I think it's also incumbent on cities, you know, we do see the stuff that's out there in the press, you know, in referendums, and talked a little bit today about not maybe being able to communicate clearly why they're there. And I think it really is incumbent on cities, if you're going to bid for an event, where does that event sit in your development plan? Where are you going? Sometimes that can happen by accident, sometimes it can happen by design, but regardless of how it happens, it's kind of really understanding at that moment in time What are you celebrating, what you've achieved? Because events are a brilliant platform for celebrating. And how are you using that event to communicate where you're going in the future? And right now, from a Birmingham perspective, that's something we're right in the depths of. Even in the next couple of days, we've got a couple of sessions where we're really honing in what is it we're telling people that this Games we're hosting in 2022 can deliver, but equally, where is it in a wider delivery plan for Birmingham and for the region? And I guess the other piece that hits me when we look at the future of events and maybe where we're going, it's getting used to being disrupted and getting used to being disruptive. And that can be very simply in the sense of, I really don't think the 6-7 year cycles that many events have are going to be as sustainable as they potentially have been in the past. Not just necessarily from a money perspective, but just that sense of time and being prepared to be bold, do things in an accelerated timeline. We've got that massive challenge in Birmingham, but it's something that we're relishing because it gives us an opportunity to kind of break away some of the rules and say, well, okay, if we've got to deliver what could have been 7 years in 4 years, well, what are the movables in this? So there are certain things we have to deliver. We've got to deliver an athlete's village. The athletes need somewhere to stay. But what can it mean from what might be some standard mechanisms of delivery? Be it in transport, be it in security. If you've had 7 years, you might do it one way. If we've got, well, now less than 4 years, it just gives us that opportunity to have that discussion and a real sense of partnership rather than it all being hoisted on an organising committee, pull this event together and move on and leave whatever is left behind. It's what is the role of a collective partnership? And again, it's something we're really working on hard with partners in Birmingham to see what can we do differently that might help the wider events industry to take lessons. If we've got Transformation 2022, we've got the new norm, lots of the federations and rights holders are having these ideas, and I think events kind of owe it to those partners to kind of challenge what's in there and really see how far can we push some of these rules that might exist.
Thanks very much indeed there, but Neil, there's lots of themes I'd like to pick up on later, particularly around sort of disruption and community engagement. And I just want to hand over now to Nadia to talk about the theme, which I know has a very different event model in terms of Eurovision from maybe some of the other sports events that we have just spoken about and that we've spoken about elsewhere in the conference.
Well, I'd say we're very similar because there's a lot of things that I relate to that have been said today. But we are a big entertainment show, and we operate on a 12-month timeline. So that makes it completely different. Just before I talk about the future, to put things into perspective, the Eurovision Song Contest team is a team of 3.5 people that work full-time on the Song Contest. We operate within the European Broadcasting Union, obviously, that you might know for its news and sports output, and particularly on the European Championships that have just taken place. You'll hear a lot of people saying, does that thing still exist, the Eurovision Song Contest? Because they're quite amazed, they remember it from the 70s, and it does still exist, and it's actually growing. It's 43 countries participating. It's a two-week event. So we have had to grow too, and our 3.5 people team has expanded, and we're working very closely with our partners, and that's how we do our yearly knowledge transfer, because we work with partners outside that are in charge of web and communication. We take our head of security with us each year. We work on issues like marketing and sponsorship, on voting, of course. And we start working the day that we know who the winner is. We start working on that evening. I know we don't know who the winner is before, so we really do start working on that day. And we then have 12 months to operate. Our natural partner is the host broadcaster. And then the second layer is the host city. So we're working with host broadcasters who are mostly public broadcasters. So part of our job is also trying to keep things within the scope of budget. Because the event has grown so much over the years, it's become a very expensive show for TVs to organize. So the next layer is obviously the host city, and that's what we're looking at now. And that's the way that we would like to expand in the future. And we're looking at ways to expand our basic team with the EBU and partners, but we're also looking at ways to involve the host city, because we don't have a city bid. We kind of impose ourselves on a country and a city, and we arrive with our Eurovision Song Contest model in a country where very often the country and the city have not really asked for this. So the host broadcaster is always very proud to organize the Eurovision Song Contest, but they don't always have the necessary budget. So we're also looking at models now on how to involve host cities at an earlier stage and making sure that the 42 or 43 countries that enter into the Eurovision Song Contest come in with a host city from the beginning.
Thank you. I'd like us maybe to pick up on that theme later as well on engaging with host cities and what that might look like. Moving to David Greco and the work that you do providing, you know, power and you know, temperature control solutions to all sorts of events. I mean, this year, you know, including Winter Olympics in Korea and Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast. Just your perspectives as I suppose the first on the panel to talk from a supplier's perspective about what the future looks like and how that's evolving from your perspective.
Well, yeah. So if you look from the suppliers, and this site is a supplier site, the temporary supplier site. First of all, it's nice to see quite a lot of clients from us, and I would divide them in two. So you have the Formula Ones, the UEFAs of this world, Eurovision, which have a very definite plan to organize their events. It's about quality, but at the right price. So very easy. Basically, we have to compete, and that's it. When you go to the multi-sports events, it's more about public funding, and the process is completely different for us, because the process is much slower. The money needs to be well spent, and it needs to be controlled. So this makes, well, what a lot of discussions have happened this morning, this just makes it more difficult, and it means that much more people are involved. You get maybe less experienced people. You maybe get more time to rethink things, whereas with, well, Formula One, Eurovision, it's very defined, and for a supplier, it's about being with the right quality at the right place.
Excellent. Thank you very much, David. And now, David, from GL Events. I mean, temporary sort of structures and innovation that you know you've brought about. You must have lots of perspective and observation about the way the events sector is moving, and particularly the sort of multi-sport and single sports event sector, and maybe some of the differences between those. But I'm just interested in your thoughts about what the future looks like from your perspective.
I've got a hope of what it looks like. I mean, all today we've heard a lot about how it's got to be more affordable for host cities and organisers to put on an event. And I think a trick that is missed by, and not criticising anyone in the room, that is missed by a lot of organisers is to engage suppliers earlier and have a genuine, honest and frank conversation with suppliers before the tender process has even begun. I know that Rugby League 2021 are apparently having some workshops even before the tender process has been done, which was good to hear last week at the MEI event. And I think the more you can involve us early on, the more benefit you'll gain from us. If we're appointed, I think you'll find that most suppliers, without any commitment from an organiser committee, are prepared, are prepared to put something in advance on the hope that we will get some work further down the line without any commitment from you guys or some of you guys. You know, we see a lot of really good people in the teams of the organising committees once you've been appointed, but a lot of time their wings are clipped by the processes that the organising committees had to put in place. So the link between the man on the ground and the guy holding the purse strings, very much what David has said, can sometimes be far too long, and that adds to costs, adds to complications, adds to confusion, ultimately adds to money at the bottom line. So I think what I would hope to see in moving forward with events is keeping away from sustainability for now, just talking about actual nuts and bolts delivery, is I would like to see the link between the supplier and the stakeholder being reduced as much as possible, so that the what is requested over here is what's delivered down here, and what's considered up here has been advised by the people that know what they're doing. Because a lot of suppliers on this room will deliver over 100 events a year of different sizes, and a lot of organisers do one event every 4 years. We've got a massive amount of knowledge on our side, which we feel isn't tapped into, I would say.
Thank you for that. And now Kevin from Rudder, and again on the supplier side, delivering modern temporary structures to many of the events, including Formula One and others that we've heard from today, including UEFA. You again must see particularly around this area of the balance between temporary facilities and permanent facilities. Describe for us just what the world looks like from your perspective and how it's changing.
It's quite an interesting question because I can see many of our clients in the room, like the UEFA, like the Formula One. For Formula One, our relationship to Formula One is about 30 years right now, and that's nearly as long as we're on the global overlay and major event market. Basically, what David just mentioned before is when we just take a look at major events and how the major events are planned in the years before, we just pitched for Qatar 20 for the Qatar World Championships. So, I can say it was a really interesting pitch because it was many square meters for us as a supplier, but in the end, we worked with a team of 8 people for 3 weeks on it, and you definitely know that you have to revise it completely within the next 2 years. So it's not about okay, there's some costs on it, but that's not the issue. That for sure, from the supplier side, you need to make some money out of your business, otherwise you won't be longer on the market. But as David have mentioned it before, as an organization committee or like a whole city, it could be a bigger effort for you to just contact your the suppliers in the longer distance in advance, just to show and ask what much experience do you have? What could we expect from your side of supplier side? I mean, it's in the first stadium. It's just a exchange of knowledge. It's just not a sales action. It's not selling. It's just an exchange of knowledge because, in the end, most of the time, if we receive a tender, it's something like, oh, it's really not like something you can sometimes really use. You figure yourself something somehow through. You put the number underneath and then hope you get awarded. After you get maybe if you're awarded, you just be kind of happy that you're awarded, but you won't hear anything. Any voice back for like half a year or maybe a year, and then you go and revise everything. It starts all over again, and you could avoid lots of costs also from the public side, just to talk a bit longer in advance.
That's excellent. I mean, it's actually the theme I think I wanted to pick up, which is common to almost everything that each of you have said, which is about early planning, about connectivity between from the supplier side with the rights holder and or the host community and being organised. And I thought, Neil, just to come back to you on some of your experience around obviously Special Olympics in Dublin in 2003 and more recently 2015 in Baku. Just thinking about some of the different models, London 2012 is another example, and clearly here we're now talking about Birmingham 2022. You know, there are some of those models which have involved what in my introductory remarks I referred to as a sort of pop-up organising committee. And I think what I mean by that is where an organising committee, as it were, is put together externally and then sort of superimposed, as it were, onto the organising company. And just your reflections on whether that works to solve this particular set of issues about delivering quality at speed, but also whether it works in terms of leaving legacy behind, which I know is something that motivates you.
Sure. So, I've sat in a few of these pop-ups. They definitely bring their challenges. And I think they can work. But I think what's really important is that early days, the host and the rights holder are clear on what their objectives are, so that when you superimpose this management team on top, they've kind of got parameters to work within. Otherwise, the individuals there will have to do that for themselves, and that may not lead to what the legacy is. So if I look at what we're working in right now in terms of Birmingham, and we've got a new model from a Commonwealth Games perspective, which is the new partnership between the CGF and Lagardère. It's how do we make that work? Now, will Birmingham as a Games benefit versus what the future might benefit? Come back to me in 4 years' time. We'll have that conversation. But what we are being really clear, particularly as the hosts between ourselves and the government right now, is we're spending the time and taking the time as a collective partnership to define what our outcomes are. So if we take the 2022 example from Birmingham as describing that as potentially fitting within this pop-up model, we'll have clear outcomes that will say this is what you're held to account to, and we can communicate. When I reflect back on Dublin, when I reflect on all the way through to my experience in Baku, what was really, really clear in both of those examples was what's the outcome. So when we worked in the Special Olympics in Dublin, it was very much driven towards the mental health agenda, mental health legislation, being really, really clear this is why we're doing it, and the Games is an opportunity then to celebrate it rather than we're just going to celebrate a big Games. And we worked in Baku in both the European Games and the following Islamic Games. It's about nation building, about state building. It was about what is the longer term economic capability that this allows the country as a platform to showcase its capability in. And it was about capacity and skill building. So it was leaving stuff behind. So again, I go back to Special Olympics. A huge investment in grassroots in the movement there, back in Ireland, to effectively triple the amount of clubs, but not just triple them, but ensure there was training there in administration, there was training there in coaching and skills development that ultimately then helped the end users, being the athletes, to develop their own skills. And equally, efforts we did in Baku way back at the European Games in building out kind of our graduate program. The real legacy, the real human capital legacy of that has been felt. There are people who started in that who are now working across the globe in the likes of technology areas, etc., who came through that program. But equally in Azerbaijan's own capability, I look at the Formula One team there, most of the people who work in that came through the Baku 2015 program. And I think Formula One would agree with me that that's a real human legacy that continues there. And what Formula One has done for the country is amazing. So it's as events, you can do these pop-ups, but you've got to be really clear on what the expected outcome is.
Can I just follow up on that? What's interesting about that vision is that how often is that actually shared with suppliers? Because I don't think it is. I think Glasgow do it very well. You know, GL this year worked with Glasgow and delivered the European Championships, and it was made really obvious to us quite early on why they were having the event, what the impact on the community was going to be with that event, and we were very well informed by Glasgow, but I would say that is the exception to the rule. Most of the time, the suppliers are brought in late. They're not told the big picture or the vision. So the man on the workshop doesn't know whether he's making a decision, for what reason that decision has been based on. Is it about the community? Is it about mental health challenges? It's got to go right from the very top vision. That should be fed right through the tender process to the people on the ground. So Glasgow did it very well, but that's rare.
I mean, there's a very strong theme. I'm just looking at the questions that are coming through, and there's three or four, and I think people are voting on them. So I'm going to read one of the most popular questions, which is sort of on this theme, which is, and I think maybe the suppliers, I don't know whether you might all have views about this, is just building on that. But how you make your approach to delivery locally relevant, not sort of applying a sort of template model, and whether that's something that you can have a part to play. I mean, that's sort of content driven, that's about sort of connectivity that we were talking about before, and whether you've got a perspective about that.
I think the story is the same at both sides. When you talk about these pop-up committees, I mean, I think in the United Kingdom you say it's chicken and egg. I mean, you cannot put all young, new people because, that would not be fair. So the good mix is to have young, good people, but experienced, older ones, which have done it before. At supplier side, it's the same. Every time we move into a country, we try to get the experts with us and offer the experts to the client, but we will engage with local community. That's something which I think I can speak for the three of us. Yeah. We do very, very hard. And let's be honest, it's part of the tenders. It has always been part of the tenders, and it's our role to engage, to leave something when we go. But I think at the moment there is a bit of a discrepancy in the local organizing committees. Yes, like David said, Glasgow was very good. European Championships was a mix of people of Glasgow 2014. There was a mix of the city. There was a mix of new people. And they left a great legacy. And they took us on the ride and on the adventure very well. But there are others where we are just the supplier, you know.
Yes, that's understood. I mean, there's a question that is sort of trending at the moment on this. It's had four votes already. Yeah, I'll ask the question two parts. Actually, I think I wanted to ask you, Nadia, a question about city engagement. I mean, I think you explained very clearly that the original engagement is between, as it were, Eurovision within EBU and the host broadcaster, and the event is developing. I mean, the number of countries is developing, but also the length and the format of the peripheral events, if I call it that, is also developing. And you mentioned about engagement with the city, and I just wonder what that might look like. I mean, my experience is that the city is ordinarily the major investor and the major beneficiary from tourism and from some of the legacy points we talked about, and in terms of social and media and economic impact. The question, which I wonder if you could sort of weave into your answer, it's now had six votes as I've been speaking, is will there ever be consideration to rebranding Eurovision, given the large number of participants outside the geographic definition of Europe? It's now had seven votes.
The Eurovision Song Contest has constantly rebranded, actually, because the branding changes every year. I mean, the local branding changes every year. The branding of the Eurovision Song Contest tends to change over the years and as it grows. Referring to your question about the city, it really depends on which city we're in. My benchmark tends to be Stockholm 16, because Stockholm... Sweden is a country that's extremely invested into the Eurovision Song Contest. They love the Eurovision Song Contest. A lot of them live for it. You'd be amazed what a huge fan community the Eurovision Song Contest has. And the city of Stockholm was actually extremely invested into the whole organization of the Song Contest. And they were also very independent financially and could take decisions on their own. So they invested very much into the Eurovision Village. They invested into the side events. They invested into the Euroclub. They invested into a lot of things. And we don't impose this on the city. So this is really something that the city decides to do on its own. And the budget they put into the Eurovision Song Contest is also something that they will decide to do on their own. We don't impose this. And this differs from one country to the next. I mean, you were talking about Baku before. We were in Baku in 2012, and they didn't have an arena. And they were so happy to have won the Eurovision Song Contest in 2011 that they actually went and built a whole huge arena that I'm not even sure has really been reused the way it should have been. But it was something that triggered a lot of interest, that triggered a lot of enthusiasm, and that's why the general involvement of the city for us is very important, because it really makes the difference during the event weeks. It makes the difference with the atmosphere. It makes a difference with the number of people that are going to travel there. Lisbon was hugely popular this year, and that's definitely the direction we're going into, a more constructed and constructive collaboration with the host city.
I mean, I don't know whether. Thank you. I mean, I don't know whether. I hope so. I mean, I'm not the one to be able to judge that. Really, the seven people who voted for that question. There are other questions coming in. I mean, is that a moment maybe just to throw things open? I think we've got about 10 minutes left to, as it were, real life questions from people who want to ask with a microphone and say where they're from. And please put your hand up if there are questions you want to ask about Birmingham Eurovision and about any of our event suppliers. I have other questions while you are thinking about questions, but please raise your hand. One of the themes that I picked up from the two Davids and Kevin was about, I don't know if I'm being sort of unfair in coming to this conclusion, is about a disconnection. I mean, I think, David, you mentioned about, you know, sometimes you're not aware of, without talking about specifics, but you're not aware of sometimes the, you know, mental health health agenda or, you know, other aspects of what a city is trying to achieve or a host is trying to achieve. And you talked about that first sort of six-month period, or Kevin, I think you mentioned the first sort of six-month period. And when you sort of get really into the sort of detail of reimagining what the relationship, because we're all about, you know, quality and legacy and, you know, delivery and engagement, you know, what could be done differently, maybe by the supplier community or interactivity? Because I noticed that too, that often an event is awarded and then there is a lull, there is a period after the event is awarded, and I'm not sure why it is or what is happening, but could that be, as it were, delivered differently or better maybe?
You're probably asking the wrong half of this table, because we would like it delivered quickly. I mean, I suspect we've got the same answer here. You're 100% correct. We would tend to sign a contract in November and then nothing happens for 6 months, and that wouldn't be unusual. And it's a dark side of the moon for 6 months. And perhaps the organisers can tell me why that happens. I know a lot of the time it's sorting contractual elements out. But I see no reason why we couldn't be drip-fed ongoing information, your ongoing process, but that doesn't seem to happen. So I haven't answered that, really. Have you got an answer for that?
We'll take a look. We're often talking about exchange between host cities or right holders, but let's talk about the real. It could be interesting that right holders like Formula One and UEFA are talking to host cities, because as Chloe has mentioned it in her presentation earlier, it shows really what kind of benefits you can take out of some events and about. We were talking about legacy, like in host city last year, in many of the panel discussions. And I think the right holders are one step further than the host cities, because they have to keep an eye on to coming back next year, because that's part of their business. And in the end, it comes to business.
Yeah, so can I answer the question on the dark art of what's happening in the background? probably not without naming names, and I'm looking up in the audience, and some people are there, so maybe I don't want to do that. But I think it comes in phases. And I think it's really important that, this is probably putting a message in a bit of self-pontificating here maybe as well, but, you know, the event gets awarded, a lot of stuff happens in a bidding phase, and there's still a lot of, you know, that it's not formed when the bid has arrived from what we're trying to achieve generally with events. That first lag, it's probably really important that people just take that step back, get back to the 50,000 feet view of the world and what are we trying to achieve. And that won't answer and won't satisfy the needs of suppliers, but I really can't tell you how many emails I get every day from John the sandwich maker about wanting to be involved in the games. I can't tell him right now, because what I need to focus my energy on now is ensuring we've got a clear and coherent message for the city and for the citizens. This is what this games, in our case, is going to achieve. But I think then the next lull starts to come when there's all the internal planning going on. And I think that's back to the challenge which I think the supplier side has put out there, and I've heard it in the past, and I think it's worth organising committees taking that step back of how quickly do we engage in the supplier's piece. Very pleased to hear what John's doing. We've had similar thoughts, but probably pick up on you probably have done some hard yards that we can learn from. But if we're going to be disrupted, and by disrupted as events is going to be that shortened time frame. So 1 month in your time frame is probably, in a Olympic context, could be 2 years. So we're all going to be challenged with shortening some of this. That's a key area where we can learn, because I'd rather the experts tell me how to do it rather than me coming up with some wild ideas of what I've seen before. But I think it's really important that post-bid, that initial bid phase, that's done. It's then being able to go back to the 50,000 feet. And we've made no apologies. In a Birmingham case, people are saying, well, why aren't you telling? We're taking our time. We want to get this 100% right. So rather than trying to achieve 50 things from the games, what are the 10 things we might achieve? What are the 5 things? And be really, really clear so we've got a strong message. And then that drives priority-based spending. That drives the ability to be really clear with suppliers, this is why we're doing it. And hopefully that's something I'd certainly be, from a selfish point of view, trying to drive through our agenda for 2022.
And I think Neil is right. And I think our role is also to give the federations, the associations, an alternative to maybe change the concept. I mean, why do we need 44 venues fully built? Why can we not take half of them temporary? I think the IOC is looking at that for the Youth Olympics now. Buenos Aires was indeed a beautiful event, back to the roots, low cost, and it works. And I think that's the future. And I think our role, and that's why we need to be engaged, because that's part of the vision. It needs to be legacy. It's always the same what I say every year. It's legacy against the cost of doing it. And I think what we are asking, and then we're really talking about this multi-sports, but that's the ones which are in trouble. F1 is not in trouble, UEFA is not in trouble, Cirque du Soleil is not in trouble. The ones which are in trouble, let's be honest, are the multi-sports ones. Mm-hmm. And I think I can speak for the three of us, because we are coming out of the overlay. We have a lot of solutions to bring to the table to make it more sustainable. But then we need to be part of the vision.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I'm going to ask another. Let's mix it up a little bit and take some questions from the audience. There are some more questions on the website. But could
Thank you. My question goes to David. And how early in the process would you want to hear from Neil about the tender documentations? But before it becomes a tender, but about engaging the process to try to find alternatives. And instead of doing something bespoke, doing something that you'd rather give your hand or your support to say, well, this is the solutions that you can bring and make things easy and cheaper.
I think how early is relevant to what to some of the necessities are, because you'll have, on a multi-sport event, you're going to have the sports themselves that are going to have specific demands that are going to have to be fulfilled by the local or larger local, some other stakeholders. So that has to be clear, and I think there's also a wish sometimes to push that back up the ladder as well, because sometimes what they ask for is, we would say on our end, why are they having that? You know, they might know why they're having that, but they've not told us why they're having that. So we're not empowered or given the information to make that decision to feed that back to them. So it goes back to the sooner the better. I mean, I don't know specifically when the Commonwealth Games is going to go out to tender, but normally it's just 4 years is very short. You know, you'd have thought 3 years out, 4 years out, we should be heavily engaged as all the commodity suppliers with helping look at sustainability, looking at what can be done at venues, because, you know, there's a hybrid between a venue being built and a greenfield site. You could have a greenfield site but put water and waste in it, so that greenfield site then becomes much more useful for future events. We could advise on how that could be done. So you're not building another venue, but you're prepping, you're sort of going halfway between the two. You know, you could put some power infrastructure in. I'll just cut out some work for you, my friend. But you could put some power infrastructure in on an event space, which would then, you know, make that event space more viable for other events moving forward. I mean, you'd want to be, I would say, 6-7 months to a year before the tender even comes out, you want to be engaging with suppliers, looking at how, you know, considering legacy, considering what is a cost-effective temporary solution and what could be. I think the Gold Coast did it quite well this year. Some of their venues, which were for, and I can't remember which one it was, became a film studio, and they really looked at that, well, 7-8 years before they actually did it. Again, involve your suppliers in that, because it might be you don't need to build a permanent structure for that. You could do something else. So, yeah, I mean, 2 or 3 years before the tender, a year before the tender comes out, and then the tender process is probably 6 months, and then you want to be awarded as soon as possible. The quicker we get awarded, the better event you will have, without a doubt.
Yes. Just to add that what we've been doing over the past few years when we choose the city within the country that's won is to actually look at the venue. That's one of the main things we look at, to see if there's an existing venue to avoid them having to build a venue. And in Tel Aviv 2019, we're actually using a convention center just like we did in Kiev in 17. And that makes things easier, even if we have to readapt it and to take some temporary solutions for press centers or hospitality areas, we do try to use existing venues.
That's pretty right, but it also shows when you go to host cities and major events, most of the temporary buildings are used as a back office when it comes to host cities. But if you take a look on all the corporate sponsors and everything, they're using all structures as well. You will agree on that, as well as a high class modern hospitality in the front end. So that's I think something we can change. Just take a walk or drive to Essen, South Africa, Rio de Janeiro, which shows up what happens if you don't think about legacy and you just build on because you on your perspective of showing how big and how much what a great city you are and what you can achieve within a short time of building permanent structures. So I think also right now we are able to provide really, really interesting solutions for temporary structures and as well solutions for nearly all parts which are used in the whole process.
Yeah, so I'm going to get on my high horse now. Maybe that we're all getting on. We're talking about venues, but I'll go back to the disruptive factor. So the temporary infrastructure guys in the room might not like me, but I think there's a real I go back to disruption. I go back to the rules. What's wrong with using venues as they are? So that I think is the continuous challenge. Yes, you have to make adaptations, but a lot of times when you go through the planning process, you're prescribed, well, it must be this square meters, and God forbid a client might meet another client of a different category in a corridor, and all those conversations, that's when you start getting this massive increase potentially in temporary infrastructure. If you just take a step back, and if you were to run the event on its own, on a standalone event, where your budget is absolutely zero, you'll start being a lot more creative with your use of space. And I think, again, I'm reflecting on what we're in the process of in Birmingham. A lot of our bid was based around the venues exist. In reality, we're building a village, which we're building as housing anyway. We're accelerating that. We're renovating a stadium at the Alexander Stadium. Was it something that needed to be done? The Games gives us a perfect platform to go and do that. And we're building a brand new aquatic centre because of the district that it's been built in. It makes sense. It helps them close down old facilities and come back with something new that's really left afterwards. Everything else we're using as it is. And I think the trick for us as the outside wearing my city hat, looking back into the organising committee, is, well, why can't you use it as it is? And really challenging some of those rules. So that we're not left either with massive permanent structures that nobody knows what to do with afterwards, or loads of temporary infrastructure that, you know, is that really sustainable going forward? So you guys don't want big boneyards full of equipment either. So.
No, and I think you're right. And we don't have to be mistaken. I mean, what you just said about Tel Aviv, that's what is also semi-temporary, is just adapting an existing venue to the event and go back out. So, yeah, I think we're reliant on that.
We have two minutes left. I'm keen to get other questions. There's a lady here in the middle, and there are a couple of other questions on the website. If you want to vote, I think you remember pigeonhole.athc2018.
My name is Patrizia Fimiani. I work for Visit Victoria on a major event called White Night. And I guess for me, you know, the platform of delivering major events, and I've been doing that for over 20 years now, has changed with counter-terrorism and the considerations of how we plan our events. Collaboration for us in Melbourne is incredibly key. So when you talk about bringing suppliers into the fold and making sure that you utilise their experience, that's sort of fundamental in our planning. You know, we not only sit with whoever's delivering the event, but obviously emergency traffic, transport, the local authority, and our suppliers are fundamental for, you know, bringing in information. It's incredibly important for us. So I think, you know, for what I've seen over the last 20 years, it's you know, it's really changing. And that feedback, be it your patrons of how you deliver the event and what they're seeking, to, you know, what's coming from the suppliers and the planning model of how things are changing, you know, that's really evolved considerably over time. And I think it's really important for, you know, those of us that deal in mass gatherings to, you know, always remember that your event is only as good as your last one that you delivered. And there can always be a problem, you know, there can always be something that can go wrong.
I was in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago and went to the Gold Cup. So I met a lot of the suppliers of the Gold Cup and got toured around the Gold Cup, what's it called? It's called Gold Cup, isn't it? Derby Day in Melbourne. Is it called Gold Cup? Is that right? Yeah. Melbourne Cup, thank you. And and you are right, that there was that good connect between suppliers and the organising there. I would suggest that currently, I'm fine, not you guys, that tender portals a crop in that relationship. So if we're going to do a tender through a portal process, which, to be fair, everyone's going down that road now, we're finding we can't express the people behind our company. We can't express the relationships we are trying to develop. You know, in a tender process, how do you score friendliness? How do you score keenness to work with somebody? You know, there's a tender just come out this week for a major event next year, and it's 60% on cost, 40% on capability. Well, as a supplier, what that says to me is they're going to go for the cheapest. They don't care whether we're going to be friendly, nice, warm, cuddly, offer best advice, because they're valuing their tender at 60% on cost. So I'm seeing Sorry? Yeah, that one is 60%. So we're seeing, you know, the evidence at the moment from my side is that portals, how tenders being scored is actually pushing that relationship further apart and not close together. I'm completely with you that it should be close together, but we're not seeing that at the moment. As a supplier, I'm not anyway. Are you?
It looks like you're poised sorry,
it looked like you were challenging me on that, but I think so. But I'm happy to challenge the guys. So I think I completely agree, and hopefully I think when we look at the future of major events, it's got to flip to what's the social value rather than race to the bottom line. Bottom line's important. These things cannot be big money waste. It's public money in many cases that are going into them. But I think it's equally back to, you know, there is the joke within the industry, and I look at friends here who've worked in OCs. You go out there with the Olympics, suddenly every supplier is adding on two zeros for to make up for some of the rings that are behind the event. So I think there's, if we're going to increase and shorten that gap, that financial dialogue, that we've got to take on that hoodoo as well.
Ben, I'm looking to you just in terms of timing. We're now on time. Have we got time for any more questions? Yes, right. Well, the most popular question is, should events bid for cities to host them rather than the other way around? You need to pause for a few moments to think about that, but that's Marcel's question, and five people have voted for that. Well, yes, Nadia.
I think it would be an interesting model. I mean, it's definitely, given, as I was saying before, the fact that the Eurovision Song Contest is kind of propulsed into a city, it would be interesting to envisage cities bidding to host. But then our winning song, we'd have a little problem with the format. We'd have to go around the format. But for the if you think about the pure organization of the event, it would be very interesting to have cities bid for the Eurovision Song Contest. I think that's something to ponder on for the future.
Anything else? Otherwise, I will ask. There's a question here which doesn't have the most votes, but I thought just might be a topic that sort of comes out of some of the things we've said, which is about what responsibility is there, both from a rights holder side and a supplier side, to respect human rights? The question was asked a bit more sort of eloquently than that. But where does the responsibility lie? What steps should be taken? What policies should be in place in a market that is fast moving and is global?
I'll happily take that because it's something we're actually in the process of working through. So there is a commitment within the whole city contract, driven by the CGF in our case, towards human rights impact assessment. Of what that means and what we might actually do around that is what we're in the process of. And I think the question has to be framed in what's the challenge or what's the problem we're trying to fix in that space. But I think there has to be, like every other aspect of human life, there's got to be that challenge in the event space of what can we do. If we frame it as human rights, or do we frame it as social value? And what are we doing to embrace communities? And somebody made a point earlier about the France 2016 model of reaching the furthest away from opportunities. We're delivering it in a games in a city and region that has exactly that challenge. And we will be looking through our jobs and skills initiatives or volunteer initiatives, etc. How far can we reach? How far can we create that opportunity? Because the age-old question will forever exist in a city when you either impose an event upon them, you bring an event theirs, what's in it for me? You've got to be able to answer that, and that's what we're right in the middle of it. But I think that's a really well-framed thing, and I'm not sure how many other events make that a mandatory, you must do something about this within the terms of their host city contract.
I don't know if any suppliers want to come in on that. Yeah, David.
I think we are not enough involved, honestly. And we discussed value in kind, and I was a bit shuffling on my chair when you asked me if I wanted to talk about value in kind. Well, value in kind could be more about that in the future, yes, for suppliers. I think I can speak for the three companies that human rights are top of it. Both of us are publicly traded, so anyway, we have a very strong policy on that. But I think in the value in kind, which are in our agreements, much more could be done around that. But I think that should be also driven by the local organizing committees, the federations, the associations. And I think that the whole of the overly temporary world would do his bit on that, for sure.
We actually ask for a guarantee from the city and the country that security and human rights issues will be guaranteed and that everything will be put in place, because we come with a big and diverse community for the Eurovision Song Contest, so we have to make sure that all the values that the Eurovision Song Contest defends are respected.
Well, maybe unless there are anything else, I think that's a note to end on, and it just remains for me just to really warmly thank our panel, Neil and Nadia, David and Kevin. Many thanks indeed.